You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 172 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carzino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello, you got excited.
Yeah.
There we go.
I'm into it.
I mean, this is not only episode 172, the Michael Bennett, the Trey Adams edition of the Peltoncast. This is the first week that we will be previewing a game that counts in the standings of the 2019 football season. Hello!
It doesn't seem like it should be here, most of all because of the fact that that game will be played in August. But here we are. And we've got a lot to get to, as usual. We've got a number of toasts this week. So let's start with what we're using to toast. What's our beer this week from our sponsor, Tavor?
From our good friends at Second Shift Brewing in a place.
Oh, that was some excellent research there. It appeared, St. Louis, Missouri here.
Not really our friends.
We
have the Little Big Hop New England Style Session IPA. I thought this was appropriate because A, there are a lot of New England IPAs, and B, New England felt like they got some good news with one of these toasts.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. The description here, we like drinking, but big beers can be overwhelming. We made Little Big Hop to provide a punch of hop aroma and flavor without killing your taste buds. This Hazy Session IPA features a touch of lactose, your favorite, along with Columbus, Simcoe, and Cascade hops. That feels very Northwest.
Man, just lactose sounds gross. Am I the only one who thinks this, that lactose in beer sounds gross?
I mean,
it's not that you can't even taste it, but it sounds gross. I just don't want to see the word. Don't tell me. Put the lactose in there. Don't tell me.
This beer is stupid good. Our beer is sponsored by Tavor, an app that offers craft beers that aren't distributed nationwide for purchase. Local breweries like Second Shift Brewing make their beers available to Tavor. You order the ones you like, and they'll be shipped together on a regular basis for a flat shipping cost. You can take advantage, too, if you sign up for an account with Tavor and enter the code PeltonCast in the promo section. You'll get $10 credit after spending your first $25 with Tavor.
All right. Well, let's get to our number of toasts.
Okay, our first toast to the Seattle Sounders for winning the Cascadia Cup with their victory in Portland last Friday, the Derby match against the Timbers. It is the second consecutive year that the Sounders have won the Cascadia Cup, among them Portland and Vancouver, in the sixth time since its creation in 2004.
Huge. I mean, a real bounce back for the Sounders. We'll talk more about this later, but not a game I was expecting them to win going into it.
No, sir. Probably not a game that they were expecting to win, quite frankly. All right, next up to the Seattle Storm for clinching a playoff berth for the fourth consecutive season and the 15th time in the franchise's 20 years of history. That happened earlier Sunday, actually, before they played.
75% of the time.
Yes.
There we go.
Which is slightly more than the percentage of teams in the WNBA that make it. It's only 67. All right, some big news that I think came out shortly after we released last week's podcast. We talked about this, but not about this particular part of it. It's emotional. This is the emotional final season of Ballers on HBO. The Rock on Instagram delivered this message that it was going to be the fifth and final season. And
wow, cue the Sarah Ballers, McLachlan. I'm wiping a tear from my eye right now.
Ballers, we hardly knew you.
I just really wonder what The Rock is going to do after the final season of Ballers on HBO. You think he'll have to return back to being the most famous movie star in the world?
It's a rough job, but somebody's got to do it. I mean, John David Washington is also a pretty big movie star now, so it's actually not that surprising.
Rob Corddry's going back to Children's Hospital.
Hey, that's good.
There have to be other Children's Hospital viewers out there.
We're going
to
talk about the live show in a second here, but get ready for a live edition of After Ballers.
Oh my God. Are we doing it?
Third Pelton brother DJ Infrared the live show.
So I'm going to have to be caught up on Ballers.
Yeah, you better watch. I mean, there's only going to be two episodes. But also, the listener who's coming to the live show, be sure to catch up on the first two episodes because I would hate to spoil anything.
Oh, yeah. Oh my god.
So on a sadder note, yeah, I'm aware that Rob Corddry was on Children's
Such
Hospital.
Such a good show.
I'm not disputing that. On a sadder note, we're pouring one out this week for Andrew Luck, who shockingly announced his retirement from the NFL on Sunday night after that first was reported by Adam Schefter of ESPN.
And kind of an interesting one for the Seahawks and Seahawks Twitter. He's kind of been not in a way that the Seahawks have been competitive with the Colts, because they've played them one time during Andrew Luck's tenure, or maybe other times,
Yeah, they played them a second time, but it was during 2017 when he missed the entire season. So Jacoby Brissett got the
Jacoby Brissett
on Sunday Night Football.
And so this,
you recall that Ben Baldwin came back for that game to watch the Luck-Wilson showdown, and then it was actually the Jacoby Brissett-Wilson showdown.
The Seahawks just won easily.
And a game where clearly the Colts had the more, you know, more cost-effective quarterback, as was evident on the field that night.
So somebody who is a strange foil in a way.
I mean, dating back to
Lex
Stanford
Luthor
and UW.
To our Superman, but like somebody who they never really faced off in the field in the same sort of way. It was more the battles that they had happened not in the pages of comic books, but on the pages of Twitter.com.
Or the internet in general.
That's where this rivalry really took place, more so than it did on the field. So it's almost like he's a foil to us in a way, but somebody who I don't think anybody in the Seahawks world ever felt any sort of like particular emotional like ill will toward, right?
No, and not that you really should feel ill will to any rival, but yeah, I mean, the Seahawks, by the way, they never beat Andrew Luck as a starting quarterback.
But it's a lot less visceral than it is when you see your team losing to somebody.
I mean, you know, these two guys were always going to be compared together because of the fact that they were in the same draft class, and they represented totally different archetypes of a quarterback. Andrew Luck was the prototypical, like, when baseball scouts talk about the good face, that's what NFL scouts saw in Andrew Luck, with his size, his arm before the injury.
His whiteness.
Yeah. And so, you know, he goes number one, right?
Can't
rightfully
describe
so.
What it is, but his face looks great.
And Russell Wilson, because of his height, is the opposite. The guy who is always slept on until he gets to the NFL and becomes ultimately a bigger star, really, than Andrew Luck was.
In a way, I mean, that's why he was the foil, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, Russell Wilson was the underdog. It's weird talking about this in past tense. Russell Wilson is the underdog.
I don't know if you can call him the underdog now that he's not a big quarterback in NFL history.
He still kind of is, in a way, right? Like,
there are certain quarters of the internet where he is, yes.
If Andrew Luck had the exact same history that Russell Wilson has had, both on the field, wins-wise, right, stats, he would be generally considered to be the greatest quarterback in the NFL at the moment, or really close to it. But Russell Wilson can do those things and sort of still can't escape the stigma, right?
I mean, the bummer about it is you would have liked for these guys to eventually get a chance to play each other in a meaningful situation, which I guess would have required to
the
be
Colts
the Super
to
Bowl.
Have gotten to a meaningful situation.
You know, they've done it before in their history. By the way, these two teams did play in conference championship games on the same day, you'll recall.
I know, but
No, one of those championship games went a lot different than the other one.
Well, we went into that game. I remember coming home. I think I was watching at your house after the Seahawks won. And it was just like, at no point did we think there was a chance the Seahawks were playing the Colts in the Super Bowl. Right? No. Distinctly remember being like, that game was over before it even started.
Pretty close. And then the second half of that game was very important. Deflategate.
Well, yeah. I mean, it mattered storyline-wise, but...
But you wanted to see this happen on the field. You didn't want to see, like, Wilson emerge as having the better career of these two quarterbacks because of the injuries to Luck that ultimately led to his premature retirement. I mean, that's, you know, obviously good for him to be able to walk away while his health is still relatively intact, but definitely a bummer to see him not able to make good on that potential.
Yeah. Well, we're sad to see Andrew Luck go. He would have been fun to continue to play against. It was weird. I mean, this is maybe an aside that we don't need to have right now, but people who are sort of like debunking, there's all these different corners of the internet that happened over the weekend, right? Because it is such
it's
a strange
take
story.
Cycle.
But also the people on the internet who are like, this isn't the craziest thing that's ever happened. Here are all these other crazier things. Which,
I mean, it's not the craziest thing that's ever happened.
I'm willing to accept that, like, a star for the Patriots murdering somebody and going to jail is like a pretty crazy story. You see this Richie Incognito thing that happened this last year also?
Yes.
I had no idea that that happened.
You haven't spent nearly enough time on Richie Incognito's Wikipedia after seeing him on Hard Knocks.
But there is something about it where it's like, you can take a player and be like, a crazier thing happened to that player. But there is something that was so unexpected about the timing. And then also
it's
having...
just out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. Like, that, getting that notification was something that I could have been expecting many notifications about the NFL, but this was not one of them. But then also, I do think that sort of like the magnitude and the position, they elevate this to such a different level where it's like a quarterback, you assume if they're generally healthy and they're generally good, is going to play until they're almost 40 at this point.
Yeah.
And so that's what kind of makes it crazier when you're like, well, Barry Sanders retired too soon. It's like Barry Sanders was a couple of years away from complete irrelevance as a running back.
I don't know about that. But yes, his skill set was not necessarily destined to age well.
Even Calvin Johnson is somebody who, like, he may have been a great receiver for a few more years after that. We're expecting literally another decade of Andrew Luck. If you would have just taken sort of the average projection for what his career would look like, we would assume that he would be playing at a pretty high level until he was about 40, because that's what you expect for quarterbacks nowadays. And it's just gone. So I think that's why what made it such a shocking story, right? Because it was just what happened was so different than what we were expecting for his career.
Yeah. All right, there's no good way to transition to our last toast, which is, of course, to Third Annual Pelton Cast Live. We are now, let me do the math on the fly, record this 9 days away. I guess, no, as we release it, we're 9 days away. As we record it, we're 10 days away. I don't know. Something like that. Friday, September 6th at Belltown Yacht Club. Doors at 7 p.m. Show at 7:30 p.m. Tickets still available, $10. With 50% of proceeds going to the Family First Center in Renton, spearheaded by former Seahawks wide receiver and former Andrew Luck teammate Doug Baldwin. My ESPN colleague Brady Henderson had a sit-down interview with Baldwin earlier this week talking about the Family First Center and, you know, everything he envisions for that. So definitely check that out. Of course, you know what to expect at this podcast.
As always, come hungry. Pelton Cast Live.
Come apparently really hungry, depending on whether we scale back some of these orders. I still think we should.
It's like The Office. It's like it's 15 half gallons of liquor enough or whatever. Half gallons of vodka enough. Come hungry. Expect surprises, special guests, and also expect our announced special guests, Ben Baldwin from The Athletic. This is your chance to come and heckle Ben Baldwin live or hear Ben Baldwin heckle the running game.
Yeah.
Aaron Rodgers. Who else ever might be in the crosshairs? We will be crowning Seattle's best sandwich with third Pelton brother Zach Whitman, a.k.a. The Decider.
I'm so excited for this.
And just confirmed recently, you might know him as Woosang on Twitter. Josh Sainer is going to be joining us for Talkin' Taco Time. It is going to be a hot Talkin' Taco Time with him and Infrared. We have to confirm Jake One's going to be in the building too. It seemed like he was.
I don't believe that Jake One is going to be in the building because I was seeing on Instagram that Tuxedo is in Japan on September 7th.
Wow. So. We have to Skype him in. It's like the exact opposite time.
Yeah.
4 a.m. Japan time. We have got, that's a bummer that Jake's not going to be in.
Podcast time zones.
This is going to be a fun show, though. There are very few tickets left. It is going to be packed. The Rainier Tallboys will be flowing at Belltown Yacht Club. Dress in your best nautical attire.
I love that Infrared is pushing this on Twitter. It's outstanding. I don't know that I'm actually going to have any nautical attire, sadly.
We have to find captain's hats.
Are they going to be similar to the pirate's hat from a couple years ago? The Nostra Tristan hat?
Oh, that was bad. That was bad news.
It wasn't maybe the best. Well, speaking of our search for Seattle's best sandwich, I think it's time to get down to it to help us determine our second, I guess it's basically a quarterfinal, but it's kind of a semifinal in our search for Seattle's best sandwich. We had to go back to a third Pelton brother who has helped us in the past. And also we're someone we're excited to see this weekend as we tailgate for the Huskies season opener. So please welcome back to the pod as third Pelton brother, Nate Taggart.
Thanks. It's an honor to be on the Trey Adams episode.
You were at the Trey Adams episode and not with the Michael Bennett episode?
I was planning on Michael Bennett, and then you gave the Husky intro. So
yeah, okay. That was good.
That's you switched to Trey Adams.
How many of these have you done? How many times have you judged a round in Seattle search for the best of?
I did dumplings. I did burgers. I think that's it. Yeah, dumplings and burgers.
All right. You're one of the most tenured third Pelton brothers.
Yeah. I also, in my intro, you forgot to mention March Madness champion and Pelton Cash trivia champion.
There you go. Wow. Yeah. That's like almost like the triple crown.
Now you need to win fantasy football this year.
No, after tonight's draft, no, that will not be happening.
Not bad.
I want to talk about that at the end, man. I just was looking through every team.
No.
Like, ooh, man, all these teams are kind of brutal. But you're
that. How can that be possible? No, that's not the 12-team league. This was the 10-team.
Talent is spread equitably. Let's say.
Okay.
Every team is bad. We should come up with a Pelton Cast EGOT.
Pelton Cast.
Oh man.
You had to have come pretty close to achieving it. Maybe if you win fantasy football this year, that we'll call that the EGOT. Winning trivia is something only you can do ever, because we're probably not going to do any more trivia.
Why are we ruling that out? That could happen again. Get on us if you want to do trivia.
I was just going to say, you guys, that needs to come back. It's been a couple of years.
All right, fine. We'll do trivia again. So then other people can Pelton Cast EGOT. Third Pelton brother, March Madness champion, trivia champion, Nate Taggart, thank you so much for joining us. This is an intense round of our search for Seattle's best sandwich between, so we have it Salumi in general. Did you also have the meatball sandwich from there?
Yep, I had the meatball sandwich and the copa and mozzarella.
All right. Then the competitor in the other corner.
I mean, the number one seed.
The number
I guess they were number two seed.
The Mamba got
seed.
Advanced to the final. There can't be a number one seed after that.
Well, it's complex. Yes. All right, the number three seed. Then let's go with that.
From the Other Coast Cafe, the Ragin' Cajun, Nate, tell us about Salumi.
Man. So I do want to tell the story. I've been to Salumi twice now. I went there on Saturday. But the first time I'd went there was about a year and a half ago. I was on jury duty, like a few blocks away, the Seattle Municipal Courthouse. And I'd never been to Salumi, heard about it a ton. We were on recess, and I ran down there during the hour to try to wait in line and get a sandwich. While I was in line, a pigeon shit on my face.
I mean, and, this is supposedly good
just
luck,
had a
right?
miserable time waiting in line. But as soon as I got inside, everything changed. I first grabbed a napkin and wiped the pigeon shit off my face. But just like seeing the meat hanging in the old location right there in the window, and like smelling the meatballs and all the fresh ingredients and everything was like incredible. So I was very excited to go back because I have not been back there since. I did not know that they moved to new location until Saturday when I was walking to the old location.
Did the same thing.
Saw the new spot.
Yep.
Yeah. It's much better as far as a space to actually like be inside of. But it's great. I love the fact that they are curing their own meats. They're making their own mozzarella there. There's like people, I don't know if they make their own bread there. There's someone making some sort of dough there. Their website, their menu says it's local breads, but I don't know.
Maybe for the pasta.
I would guess it's Macrina.
Yeah, I kind of got the vibe that it was probably Macrina. But it's just like you feel like you're in somewhere where like what you're eating is like constructed by the person that's delivering it to you, and it's super fresh and like it's very special in that way. I got the meatball sub with the listener Alicia. We split the meatball sub and copa and mozzarella. The meatball sub is, the meatballs are fantastic. I've only gotten a side of them before. I never got them on the sandwich. The sandwich is like almost inedible as a sandwich, I think, just because it's like just meatballs and sauce pouring out of bread, but still really good nonetheless. The meatball flavor had a little bit of like sweetness to it, which I wasn't expecting, but it was, you know, fantastic. And then the, I think that was on a baguette. And then the Copan mozzarella, the cold sandwich. That's what really shone to me out of these two sandwiches, just because I think the meat was just like so top tier, compared to any kind of cured meats you can get around the city. And I like absolutely love that sandwich. But that being said, both were incredible.
This was my first ever time having the meatball sandwich from Salumi.
Had you gone with cured meats in the past?
Always with cured meats. And I think the cured meats are very good.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of like, I feel like when you go there, at least I had to get some sort of cured meat.
Yeah.
And before, I know you can just get a side of meatballs, so before, that's why I just got the side, but went for the sandwich this time.
Yeah, it's kind of the bread and butter of Salumi is the cured meats. That's what they do. I don't think I was prepared for the meatball sub. And like, just
you certainly were prepared for trying to eat it on your drive home.
Eating it while driving. I've eaten a lot of sandwiches that should not be eaten while driving. And it was just like unwrapping the bag for it. It was like there was more and more and more pasta sauce as I was getting closer. And I was just like, what am I about to get into? It was like the pasta sauce as I was unfurling it was like the glass of water shaking in Jurassic Park. It was like, and those are T-Rex size meatballs in the Salumi meatball sub.
And that's like no different than eating ramen in your car. Like it's just a saucy meal.
If you get the meatballs as a side, how many does it come with?
I think it was three, just like the sandwich, from what I remember, like in a little cup.
Okay. I may have to consider that instead.
And by little, you mean a very large cup, because these are huge meatballs.
Yeah, they're gigantic meatballs.
I mean, yeah, because it is a sandwich. It is a little tricky, that's for sure.
And you went back and got the meatball sub again, or did you do something different?
No, I did the meatball again. So I had gone previously in early in the search, I think this was probably in May, and gotten the meatball, the mole salami, and the porchetta, which I think is a lot of people's favorite. The Seattle Times, one of their critics called it the best sandwich in Seattle, specifically the porchetta there. Of those three, I thought the meatball was by far the best when I was there earlier. And so that's why I went with that this time. And I think I maybe unduly influenced everyone else to get the meatball.
Well, we don't have the cured meats before.
True.
Okay. So I have to talk about the negative. It was Jurassic Park size, the sandwich, but I didn't feel like there was a lot of flavor in the meatballs. It's kind of, so I was thinking of it compared to like Grasa in Portland, like a side of meatballs. They're not as big, but they're so flavorful. They pack a punch in a way that like you want meatballs to be really rich tasting and just burst with flavor, right? Because if it's just meat, you're like, okay, this is kind of just a bunch of ground meat here. And I didn't get that from the Salumi meatballs as much as I was expecting. I thought there would be more flavor to it. It comes in a sauce that Mrs. Fantasy Genius compared to chicken cacciatore. So it has like red or green peppers in it. It's a thick sauce and it's good, but nothing about it was just like, nothing stood out flavor-wise. There was no star to the show when the meatballs should be flavor-wise. I want something to grab me and pull me in. And I felt like the Salumi meatball sub didn't quite get there.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there. I mean, they were good meatballs, but like I size wise and like the way the sauce and everything, it looked a lot like my grandma's meatballs that I grew up on, and she's not Italian, and I thought hers like her meatballs on the sub I think would have been better, because they kind of had that, you know, the attribute of just like grabbing you and pulling you in, while sometimes some bites of these ones I think they felt a little ground beefy. Maybe the flavor didn't just get through the meat, or I don't know. I have no idea how to make meatballs, but that's kind of, I kind of got the same vibe.
So, I don't know if I had the same complaint. I don't think it was as good, as much of a standout as I thought it was when I had the three sandwiches and it was one of the three. I will say that.
Maybe there's something about having like an assortment of sandwiches where the meatball jumps ahead when you're having a bunch of different flavors. Because it's probably, it's tough to call any of these sandwiches easy to eat, right? But you don't have to pull apart the cured meats in the same sort of way.
No.
Just like biting into it wise. But if I'm going back to Salumi, which I will go back to Salumi after this.
Of course.
But I'm not getting the meatball again. I'm going back to the cured meats all the way.
I might do a side of meatball. Although I also want to do it like a meat and cheese plate with a sandwich. That's another possible direction to go. All right, should we move on to the other coast? I guess that's a yes.
Let's do it.
So important news update. Since we started this search for Seattle's best sandwich, we kicked it off with the other coast. And at that point, it was right next door to Honey Hole, two of the first two sandwiches we reviewed on the same day. That is no longer the case, as I learned when I went to go to the other coast on Friday. I went to go pull it up on Google Maps and see how long it was going to take and what was the best route to take. And I'm like, why is this not coming up? Oh, that doesn't exist anymore. The other coast in Capitol Hill has closed, so they are down to just the Ballard location, the original, and then the Queen Anne location for the other coast.
Wow. So Honey Hole won out, huh?
Yeah. The other coast just, it was never going to work in Capitol Hill. It's just not.
It was there for like 5 years, I feel like.
It was never going to work long term. I never went in there and had there be more than like three other people.
Yeah.
And Honey Hole was always packed.
Which is weird because it's not nearly as good.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
I mean, if we're just breaking it down, Raging Cajun to any random Honey Hole sandwich, I might agree with you. However, the entire Honey Hole experience is better. It's just a better place to go into, and the other coast always felt like a cafeteria.
I mean, I suppose that's potentially fair. But
the atmosphere
there's a reason that that we're searching for Seattle's best sandwich.
But I'm not talking about which sandwich is better. I'm just saying it wasn't going to work on Capitol Hill. It's not enough of like Queen Anne is like a people are at work and they're going to go get lunch place. And that's where I think the other coast works pretty well, right? It's not a great hang being at the other coast.
No.
No.
So I'm guessing you went to the Ballard location, Nate. How was your Raging Cajun?
So that's the only location I've ever been to. So I usually go with the Detonator there. But
okay.
I think the last time you guys ate at other coast, you tore apart my love of the Detonator. So I went back to the Raging Cajun, which is the sandwich I've had probably more, actually.
And the Detonator's the spicier version of the Raging Cajun, basically.
Yeah, just a spicier version. I think it's got pepperoncinis added on, but more or less the same sandwich. But I went back to the Raging Cajun this time, and it was great. It is truly everything I want in a sandwich. And, you know, I don't, like, if you compare it to Salumi and stuff, like, the turkey tastes just like the boar's head turkey you get at the deli at Fred Meyer, the Cajun, the Cajun sliced turkey you get. Like, it might just be that. But, like, everything about the ingredients on this sandwich is just exactly what I want in a sandwich. Like, bread was perfectly toasted, a little bit of solidness on the outside for a little crunch, and then just the inside was just like absorbing all of that sauce, and they put a ton of sauce on it. And then the spice kind of hits you in a perfect combination with like the tomato, which I know a lot of people aren't a big fan of, like the tomatoes on these sandwiches, and this one has a lot of it. But then it's balanced out with the red onion and then the pepper jack cheese. It's just like everything together is just perfect to me. And like, I'm very glad I actually went back to the Raging Cajun this time, just because I think the Detonator kind of masks a lot of that flavor that's on basically the same sandwich. So, very happy with the sandwich this time.
So my complaint in the past has been, I think the Queen Anne location maybe wasn't always up to par. Sometimes when I'd gone there, it was good, but it wasn't like when you have the right Raging Cajun, when you have those exact right elements, like you're talking about, it is a real competitor for the best sandwich in Seattle. And so I went there today. I called ahead right before I was leaving my work and was going to drive there. I pulled up, walked right in as they were wrapping my sandwich up. I could just feel it, right? Like sandwich vibes wise. I was like, this sandwich is going to be a goddamn reverie. Like, this is the, this is the sandwich that I'm holding right here. You know, just if sandwiches had vibes, this was good vibes only sandwich.
Oh, you know the vibes.
And it was mwah, chef's kiss, the best Ragin' Cajun I've ever had in my entire life. Like you're talking about, just like all of the elements come together and the Cajun sauce with the melted cheese on it.
Oh,
and
my
you like
kind
of
yes.
dip little bits of it in the foil at the bottom. You're just like, this is it. This is what I want in a sandwich. It cannot mm-hmm. be topped.
That move of just like when you've eaten all your sandwich and there's still that sauce in the foil, just running your finger through it and eating all the rest of the sauce is just an absolute must with the sandwich.
So this was the first time I've ever gone to the Queen Anne location. And I would have to say that I agreed with Tristan's previous analysis that the Queen Anne location, which is interesting because he obviously had a very different experience going there recently, that the Queen Anne location was not up to par with the original Ballard location, or even in my mind, I didn't see a big difference quality-wise between Ballard and Capitol Hill. The big, I mean, I appreciated it as I was evaluating it, like having now gone through this entire exercise, the crunchiness of the bread that you mentioned, I thought really stood out in a positive fashion. But the negative was that there wasn't nearly enough sauce on this version of the Ragin' Cajun for my taste.
Oh, interesting.
Don't skimp on the sauce, the other coast.
Yeah.
No, you don't want to do that.
That's the sandwich.
And I wouldn't say that's been an issue ever before. I've never had that complaint before. So I think it's, again, a Queen Anne specific issue.
But this, I was at Queen Anne. It was perfect today.
It's fascinating.
You have to find the right sandwich artist.
Clearly.
Yeah, it definitely seems like there's some inconsistencies. Because, like, the sauce is what elevates the bread, too, on the sandwich. Like,
yes.
No sauce makes the bread kind of just hard, you know?
Like, the sandwich without the sauce is a sandwich that I could make at home.
Yeah, absolutely.
But with the sauce, the whole package, all of a sudden is just, it's so much better.
First off, I would like to
parts.
See you try to make the sandwich at home.
Melted cheese with turkey on a baguette? I will make that for you anytime. Anytime you want, I will make you a sandwich.
First off, I welcome that. Please do it.
It's going to be dry as hell. You don't want that. I wouldn't be able to make that sandwich because I couldn't make a sandwich that tasted that bad. I would have to put flavor in there.
Oh, jeez. Okay, Guy Fieri.
Oh, man. Anyway.
Anything else to say on the other coast?
No, I mean, I've had, like, I don't know, infinitely more other coast sandwiches than salami. I don't know if we're getting into that yet, but...
Same.
It is just a fantastic sandwich. And I had a fortunate experience, and I was planning on judging it just based off of the sandwich that I ate. And I had the right sauce to bread ratio and everything going on. So unfortunately, sounds like the Queen Anne location is pretty inconsistent, but.
So Nate, your choice to move on in this semifinal / quarterfinal / round of our search for Seattle's best sandwich, salumi versus the other coast. Nate, you want to go first?
I think what salumi is doing is beautiful, and I don't want it to go away, and I will absolutely eat there more, and I love the cured meats. But other coast, as far as putting together a sandwich that I want and crave way more often, is just far and ahead. So the other coast.
Fortunately, we're not voting anyone out here. You know, they may lose in the search for Seattle's best sandwich. They can continue to operate as a going
concern.
I was unaware.
We're not voting. Those would be real stakes all of a sudden.
Oh, man. First off, no one would give us that power. Under no circumstances would or should anyone do so. I mean, look, you get down to these final five, like, these are all huge names in Seattle sandwiches. Weirdly, in some ways, I would say that Maono, the one that got advanced all the way to the final, is, I mean, it's not necessarily a sandwich name in the same way because of the fact that people think of it first and foremost probably for fried chicken than sandwiches in specific. But these are all huge names. These are all great sandwiches. But you've got to distinguish between gradients of that greatness. And, you know, there was no question in my mind that the other coast was the better of these two sandwiches.
Wow. I wasn't sure what to expect from you, but I honestly was kind of let down by salumi, where salumi could have been going, and
maybe you got let down by me. It's possible you just got let down by me.
As usual. I will continue to go back to Salumi. Like, this isn't my last time going there. Should I have jury duty? Salumi, Il Corvo, top of the list.
I mean, Tats is right there, though.
Too. Excellent jury duty spot.
maybe I'll have all three.
but you're like trying to get on a long
trial. but this was not even in a close round to me. Like, this was as big of a blowout as Tats versus Paseo last week. This other Coast sandwich destroyed in every way the Salumi meatball sandwich. Flavor-wise, consistency-wise, just taste in general. I guess flavor and taste are the same thing. But it just, like, edibility in a way. Whereas, like, I can just eat the sandwich casually. I didn't spill it all over myself. I wanted to just...
Speak for yourself.
I didn't scoop up the marinara at the end of the Salumi sandwich. You know, like, just try to get every single bit that I could of this Raging Cajun that I had. I ate every single piece of sauce that I could find. I dipped everything, little bits every of morsel. Cheese that were melted. It was like, I just wanted more, and I wanted another sandwich after, too.
Well, yeah, you went with the baby 7-inch version. Unlike, you know, naturally I went with the full 14-inch.
My move, okay, wow, you went with the whole 14-inch. My move was, I went with Alicia, and she just wanted the baby version, and I was like, maybe we should just go with the 14 inches of sandwich, and you can eat as much as you want, and then I will gladly clean up the rest, which I did at about 10 p.m. at night. It was great to pop another 3.5 inches of other Coast in my mouth.
Oh my God. I'm sweating. That sounds amazing. Okay. Have we ever thought to ask for extra Cajun sauce on the side?
I have not thought to do that.
Yeah, it's got, yeah.
This,
I mean,
could
it sounds
be a game changer.
With the inconsistency that it seems like the different locations are throwing out there, it might be just a necessity.
Right?
If it's,
because then if
yeah.
you do get one that's not quite the perfect mix, if you have extra sauce to dip in on your own or apply yourself, you can just pour it on there. Like, that could, you know.
That could be the sneak here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so our final three is now set in our search for Seattle's best sandwich.
Man, I'm still, it's tough. I know that we elevated Mauna all the way to the finals, but I it's hard for me to say. And I know, Nate, you're a huge Mauna fan as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I'm just like craving that sandwich right now.
We could adjust on the fly here and just move all three of them to the final.
And force Zach Whitman at Peltoncast Live to go to all three locations.
I mean, he'd have more time now as opposed to having like 2 days between when we announce it next week and the actual live show. So maybe that's the play here. Maybe
I think
we put
just
all three. They've reached the medal stand, and now we've got to figure out who gets the gold, who gets the silver, and who gets the bronze.
We should do a fan vote at the live show also.
Well, obviously we're going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't do that last year, did we, for the...
I believe
tacos?
I think we did do it, and I think Taco Time won, if I recall correctly. Dixon Taco Time Northwest have been the fan vote.
What are we going to put in for the sandwich? There's no like name brand sandwich in that.
Well,
same
we just left it open-ended. People could write whatever they wanted. We didn't.
And Subway's going to win.
Oh, no.
Best teriyaki in Seattle.
I mean, while we have you here, Nate, how do you, is there any other sandwich you feel like belonged in this top, with this top five that we've been shortchanging?
Oh, man. I don't think so. These are the three sandwiches that I eat the most. I'm going to be 100% honest. If I am ever creating a sandwich, it's one of these three. And I love that, like, the top three is like divided between kind of, you know, hot deli sandwich. I don't really know what Paseo is. It's a Caribbean sandwich. And then a chicken sandwich, which is kind of out of left field. So you got a lot of variety in there. And I feel like each sandwich, you know, fits into my life at specific times. And right now I'm craving my own. But I think these are a good three.
I feel good about where we've ended up here.
Yeah.
I think our process has been sound.
Yeah. Adjusting things crazy on the fly. Yeah. Moving things all the way to the finals. Having a three-way final. Process has been pretty sound.
Look, the ends justify the means.
We're drunk with power.
With the very smallest amount of power possible.
Well, so you heard Nate help us determine what is going to be in the now three-way finals of our search for Seattle's best sandwich. Nate, you're also known as a prolific tailgater, though. And as we'll be discussing later, Husky football season is kicking off this week. What should we expect at the tailgate food-wise this weekend? An early one.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's a breakfast tailgate for sure. Don't know what time we're getting there. It's going to be, I don't know, 6 or 7. But
your animals,
it's going to be definitely centered around breakfast. I'm going to be making a hash. I've been trying to perfect my skin hash. And then I think there's a couple other, maybe French toast coming is what I heard.
Nice.
And definitely a Bloody Mary bar. So that'll be kind of where we're at. It'll be a different vibe than normal.
There was the first time that I ever had this was at your tailgate last year. Trader Joe's makes a butter and syrup mix. And I think that was on French toast last year also. Incredible.
Oh, man. Wow. I have this problem where at tailgates, I just forget to eat. I just like play games and drink beer. And,
I do not have that problem. So
I will even cook food and then I will not eat the food.
So I know exactly.
This is the year that I changed that.
You just drink your way through. Even if yeah, it's 6 a.m.
It's been the curse of the last 5 years of Husky football. So,
well, thank you so much for being here and helping us sort another round of our search for Seattle's best sandwich. Nate, we'll be seeing you at the live show on September 6th at Belltown Yacht Club, where we crown a champion of Seattle's best sandwich between our three-headed monster of competitors. We have in one corner, they moved all the way to the top, but now they're being brought back down. We have the Maono fried chicken sandwich. In another corner, we have...
It's barely a triangle rather than a ring.
Just wait. We're getting there. Hold on. In another corner, we have the winner of today's contest, the Raging Cajun from the Other Coast Cafe. And in a third corner, we have Tats Delicatessen in Pioneer Square, specifically the Tats Drami. And in that fourth corner, we have you, the listener.
What?
Where you will help us decide at the fan vote at Pelton Cast Live.
In the fourth corner is the friends we made along the way.
Oh, I didn't realize. Somehow I forgot that Tats lost out to, or beat out Paseo. So I take everything back I said. Paseo is the sandwich.
That's the one we've underrated.
Have you had Tats?
I have not. Somehow Tats has avoided me.
You're gonna want to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do yourself a favor.
Definitely before the live show, you got to try out Tats.
Okay. As in protest, my write-in vote is going to be Paseo at this point for being excluded.
That's actually not bad if Paseo comes out as the winner of the write-in vote. That's the Seattle one that.
Yeah, I mean, there's not as iconic a chain as
Dick's
or Taco Time Northwest, but, you know, that would be appropriate because the real point of the fan vote has just been to reject what we've done in our search.
I will stand by leaving a Paseo out based on their unfair labor practices, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to Tats.
Great. Thanks so much.
That's how we end every interview.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. This is awesome. Well, there you have it. I think we've got a pretty representative group for the final. I'm pretty excited about judging these three. And honestly, I don't know who the leader is.
I'm excited about eating them all again.
Like, I really could, at any given day, each of these could be Seattle's best sandwich. It is going to be razor thin margins that decide this. What I really want ultimately is you and me and Zach to all come up with a different one, which is like,
oh no, I didn't think about that. Now that there's three of us,
it doesn't seem like it's out. And then we can have the crowd vote by yelling. This is what I almost want to like orchestrate this, but I want it to be natural. But like, I feel like that'd be very fun.
That would be a lot of fun. Also, there's a lot of other people we could invite up on stage to be the fourth.
Jake One from Japan.
Yeah. Skype in.
We're going to go live. Somebody's going to have to FaceTime Jake One, wake him up out of bed. He'll be in a kimono. And he's going to have to choose what Seattle's best sandwich is.
While we're on the topic of sandwiches, really quickly, the Popeye's chicken sandwich continues to be the toast of the internet, continues to sell out rapidly, which maybe a conspiracy here. Maybe they want it to sell out and like that that inflates demand that way. We did have some listener feedback to the famous Cousin Katie's thoughts on the Popeye's chicken sandwich vis-a-vis Chick-fil-A last week.
And what was that?
This was from friend of the pod, Eden Liu.
Oh, no. Was this an email?
This was a text.
A text.
Katie can F out of here with her too much meat take.
Wow.
I'm super team famous Cousin Katie, but I cannot let this slide. And she capped it with, your heroes disappoint you.
It was really a corner that Katie took there. Although Ben B seemed to be behind Katie's take, so.
You think so?
Oh yeah,
it's inconceivable that there could be too much meat. That's what I was taking Ben B to say.
Oh, that's tough. Because he was like, thank you for standing up for the taste only crowd. It's funny that I was thinking about that just consistency-wise, because I was like, it's really good that we did this blind taste test, because we're standing in defiance of sort of judging the hipster-like preference between Paseo and Un Bien. And then right after that, I was like, you know, but Popeyes is cooler. Who cares what they taste like, because Popeyes is cooler.
Yeah, he did say, thank you to the famous Cousin Katie for staying laser-focused on what matters,
laser-focused,
the food, and ignoring what doesn't, the not food. And I want to be clear that despite my feelings about these two locations in the not food department, my take was strictly based on the food.
Yeah. And I also wanted to potentially throw Popeye's chicken sandwiches to the crowd at Peltoncast Live. You said, we're already going to have way too much food, or no one's interested in that. And it turns out we won't even be able to get them.
Yeah, I didn't say that no one was interested in that. I definitely did not say that.
We'll have no chance of even getting the sandwich, so. Thanks, Jan. We're actually recording a podcast over here. Yes, it is selling out.
Oh, dear.
We have this. The podcast was recorded in front of a live studio audience.
The real disappointment for the listener is that
they can't hear Jan.
No, that our mom will not be at the live show.
Oh yeah, and she went to Vegas this last week and didn't even go to Popeyes, as far as I've heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. It's time for sports, and we begin with our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle. And so do we.
And so does the Sonics Arena Group, which is hosting the celebration for Jack Sigma's Hall of Fame induction this Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. at Quality Athletics in Pioneer Square. I will be there and hopefully see some of the listener down there as well.
So this is the Chris Hansen Group?
Yes.
Okay.
And so they're feting Jack Sigma before he heads back to Springfield, Massachusetts for the actual induction, which will be the following Friday, as we've mentioned previously, right before our live show.
Are we expecting a packed house here?
I think it's probable, but you know, we'll see.
Speaking of
it's
Pagliacci,
a little tough to predict.
Also,
I had a speaking of Pagliacci, but okay, you go first.
Really? Well, I mean, this weekend Husky football kicks off. We're gonna go there post game, right?
I suppose so.
I feel like post-game Stone Avenue Pagliacci, that is the way to go.
First off, it's Stone Way. Good
Stone term. Way, sorry. Yes. It didn't sound right coming out of my mouth.
No. Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I probably will be too full at that point from the tailgating to eat
from
Pagliacci.
The hash.
But it won't be.
And the French toast.
It won't be from lack of interest in the Pagliacci, that's for sure. All right, maybe I'll save mine for next week.
Wait, what?
Don't worry about it.
I want to just hear it.
Don't worry about it. We're going to save it for next week.
Did you find the drop for the end of the episode?
I searched for that, and there was not a high-quality version of it online.
Who needs a high-quality version?
There was not really even a low... There was, like, not a medium quality. It was, like, a terrible audio quality.
Did you watch episodes of Almost Live?
They don't... There are not that many... So we're talking at the end, it used to say, promotional consideration provided by Pizzeria Pagliacci, because it was before it actually was changed to Pagliacci. Pagliacci Pizza.
Wow.
It was Pizzeria back in those days. But the only one that actually included that end tag credit was like recorded off of someone's VHS, and it had like, it sounded like it.
There's like not even like DVD Almost Live, is there?
There might be somewhere out there, but not on YouTube.
If anybody anywhere has a semi-high quality audio rip of that, we would love to have it.
Yes, we would. Let's talk about the Sounders, who, as we mentioned earlier, got a 2-1 win on Friday at Portland as part of MLS Rivalry Week. It was the first Sounders victory since July 14th versus Atlanta United. Had gone 0-4-2 in that span, starting with a home loss to the Timbers in a match that both of us attended. The Sounders got an early goal from Christian Roldan, then went up 2-0 after halftime through Raul Ruidíaz. Both goals were set up by Jordan Morris, who left in the 66th minute, seemed to be favoring his hamstring or his quad. No update on that, really, in terms of his health going forward.
Great.
He trained on his own Tuesday, according to Sounder at Heart, which was covering practice. The Timbers pulled back to 2-1 in the 54th minute and appeared to have the equalizer from Sounders' nemesis Brian Fernandez before the flag went up for offsides. And a twist. We've been talking about how the Sounders' expected goals have actually been really good despite the fact that they've been, the results have been so dreadful. This time, Portland dominated in expected goals, especially the non-shot version where they outscored, should have outscored the Sounders, 2.5 to 0.9. And this time, it was basically the Sounders just got super lucky and won the game.
Okay.
Which is a way better outcome, it turns out, than playing well and being unlucky. One exciting thing that happened in this game, Emmanuel Cecchini made his Sounders debut as a reserve, provided some really solid defense, I thought, in the late stages of this match. The Sounders traded a 2021 second-round pick in the MLS Super Draft to Vancouver to add the international roster spot they needed to activate Cecchini without making any corresponding moves. Nuhu remains on the roster, although he didn't play down in Portland.
So Vancouver traded an international roster spot for a second-round pick in 2021?
Yeah, I mean, apparently, I think it's each year that you have a set number of roster spots. So if you haven't added a player by now, you're not going to. It really had no value to them. It was just kind of like how much they were willing to make the Sounders pay for this.
Yeah, they didn't really. I mean, I have no idea what the value of a second-round pick in the MLS Super Draft is. It doesn't seem like it could be that high, though.
I wouldn't say it's much. I think that's a good. That's going to work out for the Sounders. The Sounders, this weekend, after this extended three-match road trip, will be back home to take on the LA Galaxy. These two teams drew 2-2 in LA earlier this month behind a pair of goals for Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Zlatan scored twice last week as the Galaxy drew 3-3 with LAFC in El Tráfico. Zlatan, last year when he first came to the MLS, refused to play on turf. Changed his stance this year, has played in games on turf, so will be available for this matchup. He's now, you know, an additional year removed from his ACL tear in 2017 that I think was to some extent a factor in this. These two teams separated by 1 point in the standings. The Sounders tied for second, technically in third with 43 points. The Galaxy tied for fourth with 42 points. Really just very little separation in the West. You've got then San Jose is another 1 point back at 41, FC Dallas at 40, and Portland lurking at 37 with a match in hand over the Sounders, and of course that home-heavy schedule the rest of the way. Reign FC with a 1-0 loss at the North Carolina Courage on Saturday, a game that was scoreless through the 82nd minute before the Courage got the lone goal. The Reign stay a point back of Utah for the fourth and final playoff spot in the NWSL. They're off this weekend for the international break as the U.S. women's national team resumes its victory tour. Still no indication of when Megan Rapinoe...
Victory tour's been going on forever.
Well, they only played one match so far. It was just several weeks ago.
Okay.
Still no indication of when Rapinoe might return from her Achilles injury. A rough week for the Storm, which suffered a 63-54 loss at home on Sunday against the likely lottery-bound Indiana Fever, and then Tuesday night were blown out in a 19-point loss to the Connecticut Sun. Those two losses dropped them to .500 on the season at 15-15, and they have now fallen a half game behind the Minnesota Lynx for the sixth spot in the WNBA playoff standings. That's crucial because the top six teams host playoff games.
I've heard you say this in so many different platforms.
Yeah, we've seen it on a number of different platforms. But back then, when I talked about it during the Storm Lynx game that I was doing as color analyst, and for the record, the Storm have not won since then.
There you go. they need you back.
They look to have like be in really good shape because they had gone a game and a half up on Minnesota with the tiebreaker. Now they're a half game back. Now, they still control their own fate, not their destiny, because destiny can't be controlled. They control their own fate. If they win out, they will be, this at worst, the sixth seed, almost certainly the sixth seed, because of the fact that they do still hold that tiebreaker, and Minnesota's half-game lead right now is in the win column rather than the loss column. So still a chance for the Storm, but they've got to get things going. Their home finale is on Sunday against the Atlanta Dream, and then Tuesday they kick off a season-ending three-game road trip against the Phoenix Mercury, another team that's right in the mix in the WNBA playoff standings. If the Storm lose that game, then the most likely outcome is they'll probably fall all the way to the eighth and final seed in the playoff standings. So time for the Storm to get things going. All right. With that roundup in the books, let's get to football.
Oh, man. I almost got goosebumps there a little bit. Like, it's here.
It is.
We have lived our lives for many months without football. And finally, this weekend, we got a taste of it last weekend with a couple of college football games, which, by the way, what did I tell you? What did I tell you would happen?
I don't know what to do.
I said there would be an embarrassing Pac-12 loss at the beginning of the year. And then, boom, week one, like August 23rd.
I don't know if that was an embarrassing loss. Hawaii's okay. Hawaii's coming here, by the way. I don't know if you're aware of that. God,
everything's scary.
They got to get ready for that option attack, which Eastern actually will provide some preparation for that. But Hawaii looked good. That was, and I mean, what a thrilling outcome.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I watched it like as I was leaving Atlanta the next day, and it was kind of disorienting. I'm like, wait, there was football happening? You know, this is like, this is August 25th. I should not be seeing highlights from the day before.
I watched the end of that game live. I tuned in with like 4 minutes to go to see Arizona commit three consecutive penalties when they were kicking what was supposed to be a 38-yard field goal. And somehow they have a kicker who's capable of making a 53-yard field goal.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Hit the field goal?
Yeah. And that's how they got within a touchdown. Got the ball back. And then Khalil Tate nearly runs it in from the fucking 40 on the final play of the game, only to get stopped 1 yard short because he didn't try to dive and get flipped into the end zone like Ortiz Jenkins.
I know,
the Huskies in 1998.
It would have been much lower stakes the opening week against Hawaii.
It's
but
true.
Would have been thrilling stuff. Anyway, Husky football kicks off this weekend against the terrifying Eagles of Eastern Washington.
Yeah, that's true.
A team who has given the Huskies...
Baby Fantasy Genius would probably know that. Not anymore. Yeah.
Who has given... You can hear the disappointment in my voice. that only a father could have for their child. given the Huskies a lot of trouble in their last two meetings.
Their only two meetings. They've only played twice all time because UW, for a long period of time, had a rule that they never played any non-FBS opponents. And that changed about a decade ago, more or less. And so since then, they've played Eastern twice. In 2011, where they won 30-27, when Bo Levi Mitchell got picked off in the end zone on a drive that could have won them the game. Kind of a preview of the 2012/13 NFC Championship game. And then...
That's exactly...
Similar, again, similar stakes. 2014, a 59-52 victory for the Huskies against Vernon Adams, who threw seven touchdowns in that game.
Both terrifying games. Because you can't lose to Eastern. I mean, they opened themselves up to playing against FCS teams and then have played the best FCS team, a team that is definitely capable of beating the Huskies, was capable in any of these times of beating the Huskies.
And has been capable of beating Wazoo and has done it a number of times to start the season.
Going into this game, I don't look at it and say it's a, you know, slam dunk victory.
No, not at all. Because, I mean, this is just about as good as any Eastern team we've seen. They are ranked number three in the FCS coaches polls. They lost to North Dakota State in last year's FCS championship game. A cool thing about the Sagarin rankings for college football is that they include all the Division I teams, both FBS and FCS. And so if you do that in their preseason projections, they have Eastern Washington 104th across those two. Slightly ahead of Oregon State at 110. I mean,
definitely ahead of a lot of major conference teams.
This is their third year under head coach Aaron Best, who was the offensive coordinator under Bo Baldwin before Baldwin took the offensive coordinator job at Cal. Speaking of terrifying teams the Huskies play early in the season.
Oh, my God.
Eastern returns five starters on offense from last year's team, including dual-threat quarterback Eric Berrier, and four on defense. Berrier took over as the starter in week six after a season-ending injury to Gage Gubrud, and is a redshirt freshman, completed 61% of his passes for 7.9 yards per attempt and ran for 613 yards with 6.2 yards per carry. So that's I think where he's probably, you know, he's a fine passer, especially for, you know, a redshirt freshman that was really solid, but really scary with his legs.
This is terrifying. Right?
Yeah. I mean, by the way, we went this far. We didn't talk about the biggest Husky news.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how we got here. Eastern is so scary that we can't even talk about this other news. And maybe we're the only ones who are as like. And realistically, the Huskies will probably win this game comfortably. They are a much better team than they were either of those two previous appearances. Eastern is maybe probably not as good as they were then. I mean, Vernon Adams is a major conference quarterback. Cooper Kupp on that team was a second round draft pick.
What has Cooper Kupp done lately? By the way, Bo Levi Mitchell turns out two-time CFL MVP now.
There you go. In fact, what has Cooper Kupp done lately?
That was a joke.
Okay.
It was sarcasm.
I'm just saying they were very.
Do you think that was like an ACL reference?
Weird.
I mean, it's funny because the fact that Vernon Adams is the first guy we think of from that game, and that Vernon Adams is also starting in the CFL, has not really made it, you know, had the pro career that we thought he might have. Cooper Kupp is just a key cog in one of the NFL's best teams. That's all he is.
Came back stronger and faster from the ACL injury.
That's the word. That's what I hear from many times. So the big news from Montlake last week was that Jacob Eason was named the UW starting Jake/quarterback. Coach Pete said as he was making this announcement that Jake Haner would also play in the opener. But then Haner left the program on Saturday to seek a transfer.
Yeah, I think it was pretty clear that Jacob Eason won that job. I mean, we were talking about this a week ago. It was like...
I think I put in like 80%, so I clearly way underestimated it.
Oh, and this is good news.
That...
No, maybe not necessarily that Haner's transferring? Jake Haner left, but that a quarterback has been declared, and it's like, okay, Jacob Eason won this job. And that's what we wanted to see. We wanted to see a quarterback, whether it was Jake Haner, Jacob Eason, Dylan Morris, whomever.
Whoa, it can't be someone not named Jake or Jacob. It could have been Jacob Sermon.
Jacob Sermon, any person. We wanted somebody to win the job.
Any Jake.
And it feels like Jacob Eason did this. It feels like he's kind of taken command.
But Jake Haner clearly didn't feel like Jacob Eason had won it.
No, he probably did, and that's why he left. If he was like, that guy sucks.
I mean, that was the quotes from his father in the Athletic piece.
Or that he'd played better.
Christian Capel, like, that's why I think he was frustrated, is because he felt like he had played better, and that probably felt like, I mean, not to put words in his mouth here, but felt like Eason had been anointed the whole time.
He had? I mean, that's the deal. The second that Jacob Eason transferred to UW, we knew what the deal was. We knew who would be starting this game and for this team this season.
I mean, I think if it were that open and shut, you wouldn't have had this competition. I don't think this was quite on the level of, like, you know, where at Oklahoma, where Jalen Hurts, like, we're going to have a competition. Never know who could start at quarterback. Like, Haner had more experience in the system. Like, I don't think it was inconceivable that he could have won the job. But he didn't.
Yeah, he didn't. And that's the deal. Jacob Eason is our starting quarterback. Everybody needs to cool off and just come to terms with it.
I mean, I think an interesting thing.
And by everybody, I mean only you. You and only you. You're the only naysayer.
I'm not. Well, yeah. I mean, we'll see.
I actually was in Athens, Georgia this weekend. And there was a person, like, the people around me knew so much about the UW football program.
Wait, really?
It was kind of crazy. Yeah, when we were talking about Jake Haner transferring, it was just somebody who has, he was just saying, he said that he cheers for the Pac-12, but, like, he has no affiliation to UW in any way. He's like, oh, yeah, Jake Haner transferred, Jacob Eason won. I'm like, how do you know that? Like,
it was a surprisingly big story. It was, I think, on at least the college football front page and possibly the front page of ESPN.com, the Haner transfer story.
Oh, and I can tell you that the person who is a Georgia Bulldog fan in Athens, Georgia, talked a lot of shit about Jacob Eason.
I mean, they've got their own Jake.
It's like, yeah.
They're doing fine.
They've got
in that
their own Jake problems to deal with.
I don't know. Is that a problem?
No, Jake problem? Not a problem.
Not a problem.
But they've
got their own Jake transfers.
Jacob Eason is to them not the golden boy like he is here.
Yeah, because indeed saw his results.
He's there, Jake Hayner.
And the statistics that I've looked at also see his results.
Oh, God.
So we'll see. But, I mean, the big thing about the Hayner transfer, and I think one of the reasons this was a surprise is kind of the theory that I think was out there last fall and last winter was, okay, Easton's going to be the starter in 2019, and then he's going to go to the NFL.
Yes.
As a, you know, he'll have spent 4 years in college at that point, even though he'd still have a year of eligibility as a transfer. It doesn't seem like the NFL is as interested in Jacob Eason as you might think they are.
Why do you say that?
Well, just, I mean, before, we still haven't seen the Tasteful Profanity Live podcast that we were a part of a couple weeks ago come on their feed yet, but one of the questions that we were asked during that segment is who will be the highest drafted Husky player in 2020? And so I was doing some research ahead of that. Your answer was Eason, and none of the mock drafts seem to have him as more than like, you know, a third or fourth rounder at this point.
Interesting.
So at that point, it probably would not be worth leaving early. And I wonder if that factored into the decision. Because if it was just 1 year where you were going to have to sit out either way, Hayner will lose a year of eligibility by transferring at this point. Yeah. Since he's already redshirted, he'll have two to play at his new school. He would have had two to play at UW. If you thought that was the case, then it probably was worth sticking around.
Yeah.
So I don't know quite what to read. No, what it does is it leaves the Huskies really short on experience at that position. Behind Eason, they have redshirt freshman Jacob Sermon, true freshman Dylan Morris, neither of whom obviously have ever taken a snap. And that's one reason it would be nice if the Huskies could get a comfortable win against Eastern and play one of those guys in the, you know, presumably Sermon, in the fourth quarter, because you never know what's going to happen if you're going to need a backup at some point this season, and you'd hate for him not to have any experience at all.
Oh, God. Well, so Jacob Eason this weekend against Eastern, probably not going to be facing a top-notch defense.
I mean, I don't know how different Eastern is from these previous two meetings, but the commonality in those two games, the Huskies really emphasized the run game in both of those and were successful just kind of, you know, using their size and strength on the offensive line to run over those teams. And that should be, I think, something they're able to do on Saturday as well when you look at the experience and the quality on their offensive line and take some of the pressure off Eason to have a really big game right away. I mean, that 2014 game win where they scored 59 points, the starting quarterback was Siler Miles in that game. So the run game was key to that, including a 59-yard touchdown by Shaq Thompson.
Oh, man. Who do we expect to see in the backfield the most?
I mean, Savon Ahmed is clearly the starter.
Okay.
The question I think that is on everyone's mind is whether he's going to get the same share of the workload that Miles Gaskin did over the last basically 4 years.
I still just do not see that happen.
It seems unlikely.
Who is he splitting time with?
Well, you've also got in the mix, you've got Sean McGrew. You've got Kamari Pleasant. You've got some younger players who might factor into that mix a little bit. But, you know, those are the two guys who are, you know, experienced. Again, I think a position where you'd love to get a number of guys in and get some experience over the course of that game. I mean, redshirt freshman Richard Newton, someone also has been mentioned, is, you know, working his way into the depth chart. So I think he could be the other guy who maybe, you know, gets some carries on Saturday.
Okay. Well, I think it's good for the defense to see a very good offense, or as good as an offense as you could potentially face from a school like Eastern in week one. Going into having that early season Pac-12 game against Cal,
right.
The offense isn't the same necessarily. Eastern seems like their quarterback scrambles a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a run-heavier offense now.
As opposed to more of the air raid of Cal, but they're still going to get experience against what we call like a fairly high-octane offense,
yeah.
All things considered. So I'm fascinated to see it. Do we have a percentage chance of victory?
I mean, I would still say like 95.
I feel like it's 95.
It seems like a good place to go. I mean, the other thing
but
that
happened... it's not 100.
It is decidedly not 100. The Huskies put out their first depth chart last week for the 2019 season. Not a lot of huge surprises on that, I wouldn't say. It was kind of a surprising lack of, you know, usually you see a lot of positions where they're like, you know, either or. this time of the year. But, you know, I think that was the only position, if I recall correctly, that was in or was Kate Otten and Hunter Bryant at tight end, where you know that both of those guys are going to play a lot no matter which of them is officially
Bryant
the starter.
Is Hunter
healthy?
He's going to miss a few weeks.
No, he's healthy.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Coach Pete was asked about it on Monday, and he was curious why he was being asked about it.
Okay. So there we go.
I guess there's maybe some concern about it, but I don't think there's a specific concern. Maybe the biggest surprise was Chico McClatcher being listed as a starter at wide receiver. Ty Jones is a reserve. Jones had still been limited due to injury in fall camp. And it sounds like we talked about this earlier. McClatcher, by all accounts, has been, you know, kind of picked up where he left off before his injury 2 years ago at Colorado.
All right.
So that's you know, kind of exciting, and at a position where the Huskies need him to play well as part of their depth there. In the secondary, you've got several young players stepping into starting roles. True freshman Cameron Williams at one of the safety spots. Redshirt freshman Kyler Gordon at cornerback. So, you know, there's going to be some youth there, but a position that the Huskies have successfully turned over numerous times in the past.
I'm excited to watch this. I hope that the crowd is out in a way that just judging from the internet that maybe they won't be. I mean, this is
it's way
before school starts. So there's not going to be a big contingent from the student section. And I just hope that it's a good crowd, even if it's not a great crowd, that it's a good crowd. And, you know, we can still get behind the team and also building up for a Pac-12 game next week.
Yeah. Yeah. Very close to that. Let's wrap it up with the Seahawks, who got a 23-15 preseason win on Saturday against the LA Chargers, a game where the Seahawks played their starters way more, not as much as they traditionally have in third preseason games, but way more than the Chargers.
Pete can't help himself. You know that he can't. He just, it's not even a philosophy thing. It's literally just he cannot help himself.
I mean,
he's been doing this shit for like 60 years and he's not changing now.
Just because Sean McVay comes in and goes to the Super Bowl and not playing at the start of the preseason, you think that's going to affect Pete? I mean,
you think a 34-year-old goddamn head coach is going to change how Pete Carroll is approaching the preseason?
I mean, he clearly did change how he's approaching it. Like, historically, you've played the starters in week three into the second half.
Oh, God.
And they didn't do that in this game. I mean, the most important thing is that the starters really came through this game largely unscathed. Unfortunately, now that wasn't true in practice with David Moore, who suffered a shoulder injury that will likely keep him out into the regular season, but will not.
Sorry, we're pretty deep in wide receiver.
Yeah, that's true. Will not force him to go to IR. We want to talk about news or takeaways from the game first.
Well, I didn't see any of the game, so let's just get that out of the way.
Okay. I mean, it was a little difficult to evaluate because of the fact that it was a Seahawks starter.
Because it was
often
a preseason game.
Second string.
Every preseason game is a little hard to evaluate.
I mean, the single most exciting thing about this game was CJ Procise having a thrilling drive. He, you know, had, I believe, 6 carries for 32 yards. Also had a nice catch in the screen game. And I thought that was really important because, you know, our friends at Beast Poet have often talked about how he's the most talented running back still on the Seahawks roster. And I got to be honest, I was pretty skeptical of that. You know, my thought was, look, he was obviously amazing as a rookie when he was so electric in those New England and Philadelphia games.
Difficult to, like, define talent in that way.
Also, you know, running backs are interchangeable, so... Although not necessarily in terms of receiving, which is the thing that is element that CJ Procise obviously offers as a converted wide receiver. But, you know, my thought was that the injuries had kind of taken their toll on his athleticism, because when we did see him during last year's preseason, he didn't look like that same kind of electric athlete that he had as a rookie. And on Saturday, he did look like that player. So that was what was exciting to see about that, even if, you know, you can't necessarily take
it gives me like let's just cool off here. Like, this was a preseason game, and it's like the three greatest games of CJ Procise's career: the game against the Patriots, the following week against the Eagles, was it?
Yeah.
Where he got injured, and then a preseason game. Like, he was...
Well, there's not been that many more games.
We're talking about he was playing an extremely high level against the New England Patriots on Sunday night, and this is a preseason game. Like, these two things are not the same.
But that was a long time ago now.
Sure. I'm just saying,
we needed to see it still existed.
Yeah, Great. I'm just saying, let's not say, we're like, Pete had the quote, and he's like, I don't give up on people easy. I'm like, he didn't score a touchdown in the Super Bowl. He had a good preseason game. You could say the same thing about Jazz Ferguson. Like, let's just, everybody needs to cool off for a second. This is not proof that CJ ProSize, and look, maybe he will, but this game
but
is
the
not
The question
proof
has never that, been his ability, again, aside from that concern that I mentioned.
About his ability?
His ability to stay on the field. So we'll see what happens there. But it's reason enough to feel some legit excitement.
Yeah.
Even if cautious about CJ ProSize.
I mean, really, what it is it makes me feel like we would rather have him on the roster than a Bo Scarborough or a Travis Homer.
I think they'll probably still keep Homer. My expectation is they'll keep four running backs.
Two tight end, two fullbacks.
They're going to claim a fullback. A
couple of H-backs.
Michael Kendricks, I thought, had a really nice night. Was impressive as a playmaker in this one. Had six tackles in his time on the field. You know, kind of continuing to amp up the hype about this best linebacking core in football. It was Ugo Amadi got the most of the work in the return game. It was kind of a rough game for him in terms of muffing and fumbling kicks. So I don't know how long that's going to continue.
Oh boy!
But played well in the secondary.
All right, let's talk about stories.
I would say overall, though, like you were so down on the preseason last week, and this game got me fired up about preseason.
There we go.
Pete was fired up. I was fired up.
He was pumped and jacked.
Very excited about John Ursua.
John Ursua is awesome.
Drafted him in the last round of one of our Pelton Cast fantasy leagues.
That was bold.
I mean, look, I'm just going to cut whoever's in
okay,
that
well,
spot.
Let's talk about the wide receiver news that came out of camp today.
So in addition to the David Moore news, they waived Amari Darboe and picked up a couple of wide receivers off the street, basically just to serve as depth, I think, largely for this last preseason game.
Okay, week one, the Seahawks are going to a four wide receiver set. Who are those four wide receivers?
Well, so it sounds like DK Metcalf may be back for week one. Pete Carroll remains extremely, as he is about most injuries, extremely optimistic about his chances of getting back. So maybe.
But I'm asking you right now, not Pete Carroll's excitement, who are the four wide receivers week one?
I mean, I don't know what procedure it was that Metcalf had done, but I think Metcalf will be back out there.
Okay.
So it's him. It's obviously Tyler Lockett. I think it probably is Ursua. And then Jerron Brown.
Wow. Yeah. But so John Ursua as a seventh round draft pick?
Yes.
Could be on the field in week one, which is a unique situation.
I mean, you know, it happens. Doug Baldwin was undrafted.
Yeah, it's great. I'm excited about it. I mean, I'm excited about sort of turning the page. And I think kind of it's tough to really judge because we haven't seen these players play against first-team defenses necessarily. But sort of something that we've seen just glancing through the stats even in this preseason game is Russell Wilson can make anybody look like a good receiver.
Yeah, that's probably true. It was a very like Russell Wilson-y game in terms of taking a lot of deep shots. The Seahawks were very successful using play action in this game, as you'd kind of expect in a preseason setting. Russ, 6 of 9, 473 yards during his brief. He, you know, Zach Whitman mentioned on his Twitter, he also just like looks more spry as a runner than he has the last couple seasons.
He's kept the ball way too many times.
Way too many times. But three carries for 31 yards in this one.
And should we expect to see him at all on Thursday night against the Raiders?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I would be surprised. I mean, maybe one drive, but I would be surprised.
Who do we think has the inside track for a backup quarterback?
I think Geno Smith played well enough. He got all the work in this game after Wilson went out because Paxton Lynch was still sidelined.
Geno Smith's revenge game.
That is true. I mean, he wasn't outstanding, but he was good enough that, you know, I think that Paxton Lynch would need a big game on Thursday to unseat him.
What day are cuts? This weekend?
Yeah. All right. Saturday.
And then just cut everybody all at once.
There's no longer a cut down to whatever the number was, 85 or whatever it was, prior to the 53. You go directly from 90 to 53. So there's going to be a lot of cuts, including some notable names, I'm sure. Nas Jones went to IR in another move that the Seahawks made on Tuesday. So another one of the Seahawks' third-round picks in 2017, along with Darboe, who hasn't necessarily panned out the way they were hoping.
Sad.
Sound like he was in jeopardy of getting cut before suffering that injury. So we'll see if they work an injury settlement or if he stays on IR. On the offensive line, George Fant expected back for week one. Pete said it's going to be a race for Mike Iupati to get there.
Okay.
Which you don't want to hear about an injury.
It's going to be a race.
There's some things you want to hear. It's going to be a race. Like, you know, if two fast people are like arguing and they're going to race.
So then do we think that George Fant steps into that spot?
No.
Okay.
I mean, they would.
So then what is the starting offensive line in week one if Mike Iupati's out?
I mean, the Posick's been in that spot, right?
So it goes Dwayne Brown, Posick, Britt, Fluker, Effetti.
Yep.
That's at left guard.
I think so, yes.
Okay. We're fine with that.
I mean, yeah, it's we can live what with it this. Is.
Yeah. And then you have Fant as depth, six offensive linemen, slash pass catcher, and then Mike Iupati beyond that. I think the offensive line is in a fine shape. So my question for you is, there are rumblings around the NFL. There was a report today about Jadeveon Clowney having the Texans having conversations with the Dolphins about training him there, but him preferring to play with either the Seahawks or the Eagles.
Yeah, there was Aaron Wilson of the Houston Chronicle who reported that those were his two preferred destinations. The Dolphins seemed to be the most motivated to make a deal. Ian Rappaport of NFL.com was the first to report that Dolphins coach Brian Flores and other members of the organization were given permission by the Texans to meet with Clowney, who has yet to sign his $16 million tender as a franchise player. He would have to sign his contract first before a trade, and then he can't sign a multi-year deal with the Texans or any team that acquires him in trade because it's after the July 15th deadline to do that. So, you know, any team that's doing that, you would have the chance to, you know, re-sign him or extend him after the season, but for now you would be doing it as a one-year rental.
Okay, let's just go down this path of things that we don't want to have happen. The talk is that the Texans are looking for an offensive lineman, right?
Yes.
Who is that player? Obviously, it's not Dwayne Brown, right? Who's the player? Oh,
yes. People have been mentioning Effetti as a possibility.
So it's Jermaine Effetti plus X draft pick for Jadeveon Clowney?
Maybe a running back gets involved as well with Lamar Miller suffering a torn ACL. If they valued Rashad Penny.
I mean, we know who the running back would be. No, I don't know if the Seahawks are ready to give up on Rashad Penny, although he could got his stat line for that game. This preseason has to have been pretty brutal for Rashad Penny.
It has been.
Okay, so what do we think about this as... I mean, what do we think about this? I'm going to let you answer, and then I'm going to complain about it. As a potential trade for the Seahawks.
I mean, so the first off, the good news is that the Texans are reportedly no longer demanding a first-round pick as part of this deal.
Just get the fuck out of here. To pay somebody $16 million for 1 year and not be able to re-sign him?
I mean...
The Seahawks have done dumber things.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you get to the point where the draft pick isn't that much better than what you could potentially recoup as a compensatory pick if he left in free agency, then maybe it makes sense. I just don't think it's the direction the Seahawks should be going, because, like, they're not a team that's a player away from making noise. Maybe they're a player like Jadeveon Clowney away from making the playoffs, but, you know, even if they do, I don't think it's a team that, you know, potentially goes deep in the playoffs.
This has never worked. Never, ever, ever has this worked, both really in the short term or in the long term. I mean, in the short term,
ever?
For the Seahawks?
No, it has never worked for the Seahawks.
I mean, maybe the best version of a trade like this for the Seahawks in the short term was Percy Harvin, because he managed to return a kick in the Super Bowl. I mean, it didn't affect them.
He only punched one person before the Super Bowl.
But he probably helped them on the field in a couple of occasions. I mean, the Jimmy Graham thing wasn't bad. But then we start getting into trades that were just like Deion Branch was bad, and Sheldon Richardson was an absolute train wreck. And that's what
that's Sheldon Richardson's fault, but yes.
No, not because of Sheldon Richardson. They just gave up a lot for a player that they had for 1 year, didn't make the playoffs, and then he was gone.
And I don't think they recouped a comp pick that year because they signed too many free agents.
Like, you have learned from the Seahawks.
one would think, based on the Frank Clark trade, that they've learned from it.
But. Well, that's the other thing. It's just like, if you're that desperate and you want to give up assets and pay a lot of money to a pass rusher, just re-sign Frank Clark.
I mean, I would probably rather have, you know, let's say it takes Kansas City's second round pick was the pick they got this year, right? They get the first rounder next year.
No, they got a first rounder.
Oh, yeah, they got a first rounder. So they get the second rounder next year. So if they were able, like, if they were to trade Kansas City's second round pick for Clowney right now, like, I'd still make that combination of trades. I'd rather have Clowney and a first rounder than Frank Clark.
So you would trade right now Kansas City's second round pick?
No, I didn't say that. I would be okay with it. I probably wouldn't, because to me, you should be kind of just building with cheap talent as much as possible. But I would say that the Frank Clark trade was like an A+, and the Clowney trade would be like a C. Like, the average grade is still pretty good. That makes sense?
What is the draft pick where you feel good about this trade?
I mean, in the event that it was somehow like, you know, a third, or you give up a third Rashad Penny, a second, and you get some sort of like mid-round pick back, then I would feel like that's a really strong trade.
You think so?
Yeah.
If you give up a second and get like a fourth back?
Yeah. Because first off, they're just going to trade down for the fourth anyway. I don't know if you're aware of this.
I wanted to look exactly what they got from the Chiefs. 2019 third round pick and a conditional 2020 second round pick. Okay. And the condition would just be wherever it falls. Is that why it's conditional, or something needs to happen?
It could be something in terms of playing time. I didn't remember that it was conditional, though.
I just don't know. I mean, they would have to pay Jadeveon Clowney a lot of money for 1 year. Like, his value to the team.
I mean, Jadeveon Clowney on the open market is going to command more than $16 million, isn't he? I mean, what's Frank Clark making this season? Like, what? I mean,
Clark is a lot better than Jadeveon Clowney on the field.
Is he?
Let's look at their sacks.
A lot better?
Frank Clark had almost as many sacks last season as Jadeveon Clowney has in his career.
Okay.
Do you want me to check this? Frank Clark had 13 sacks last year. Jadeveon Clowney has 21 sacks for his career.
I don't know if I would say that's almost, but maybe I haven't done sufficient research into Jadeveon.
I mean, that's... Jadeveon Clowney is still sort of experiencing, in a way, a bit of the Andrew Luck effect, right? Where he was drafted is influencing how people are viewing him as a player. Now, I mean, I'm not getting any sort of like advanced stats here, because sacks obviously are not everything. But like, you're still talking about paying a very large amount to a player and giving up something for the right to pay him a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to have to pay a lot of money for good players. I don't know if I see that as his big a factor.
He has 29 total sacks for his career. In 5 years, only played 4 games in his rookie year. Frank Clark has 35 in 4 years. I mean, like, there's not a massive difference between the two, but Frank Clark on the field is a better pass rusher than Jadeveon Clowney is.
Okay. I mean, Frank Clark commanded a lot more. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I mean,
it would take for me, like, if the Seahawks trade any sort of significant value, and so he signed a 5-year, $105 million contract. That's not that big of a difference between what Jadeveon Clowney is getting for the franchise tag.
I mean, I think in terms of the long-term guarantees, especially for a team that's kind of wary of those after what's happened with, you know, Cam Chancellor in particular.
I'm shocked that you're not more down on this.
I mean, like, I'm not pro it, but I don't think it's the end of the world.
If they're giving up a third-round pick to have Jadeveon Clowney for 1 year and then let him walk.
But then you get a third-round pick as a comp pick.
Well, it seems like the Seahawks figured out comp picks this last offseason.
Yeah.
So
I don't see what the downside is there.
Okay, I'll be fine with that.
I mean, that to me is a great deal. Like, obviously, you get the pick a year later than you would give up the pick. There's some time value of the pick there, but
they will still
get Jadeveon Clowney for the year.
And they'll still go into next year's draft with pretty good capital.
Yeah.
That
would be like a huge steal.
Okay, so I'm okay with this, what you're talking about, provided they do not give up an offensive lineman, though. Well, we know that they didn't pick up. You're doing all sorts of insane research over here.
I'm trying to look up his pressures. Man, Clowney committed the most penalties on defense in the NFL last year, apparently. I did not realize that. Had 35 hurries last year, according to Football Outsiders Almanac. Frank Clark had 34.
Interesting.
So his, and I think the you know, pressures in general are a better predictor of future sacks than sacks are. So I don't know how, you know, I don't know their methodology for hurries off the top of my head versus pressures, but that seems to indicate that Clark was probably a little bit lucky last year and Clowney was probably a little bit unlucky in terms of their sack totals.
Future sacks.
Yeah.
So I'm okay if they give up a running back in this trade, not named Chris Carson or CJ ProSize. I'm not okay with them giving up an offensive lineman. We know that they declined the option for Jermaine Fetty, which I really thought was kind of an interesting move.
It was, yeah.
I don't know if I fully understood it as a decision, because I do think that sort of controlling those contracts at a relatively reasonable number is one of the most valuable things you can do. And I honestly think Jermaine Fetty on the open market is probably worth a good chunk of money.
I mean, the downside is that it's not that it's guaranteed for injury. So if he got hurt this year, then, you know, you could have downside there.
Okay. But shaking up the offensive line that's played together for most of last year, and then for all of this preseason, doing that, I think, would be a very bad decision. You know, because you're taking away from that consistency that everybody has together. And it's like, give up a third-round pick, give up Rashad Penny, fine. Do that and go get Jadeveon Clowney. But anything beyond that is too much to pay for 1 year.
So on the topic of the pass rush, Ziggy Ansah practiced for the first time with the Seahawks on Tuesday. LJ Collier, this year's first-round pick, also ramping up his practice activity after that sprained ankle. And then the last injury note, Marquise Blair, another rookie, anticipated to play in the preseason finale after missing Saturday's game due to his back.
Kind of cool to see. I mean, LJ Collier coming back in time to potentially be able to play in week one is interesting.
Yeah. And as well as Ansah. So I think that's it as far as Seahawks.
Is there anything that we're paying attention to in this fourth and final preseason game? Or just get through it?
I'm interested in some of the position battles.
I'm going to check out Taco Time Northwest.
You checking that out before the...
Absolutely, I am.
To go at CenturyLink Field on Thursday? Yeah. Okay. I think that linebacker will be kind of the back end of that depth chart. Ben Burkervin, Shaquem Griffin seems like a long shot right now to make the team. So that'll be interesting. There, you know, there's definitely still some spots on the roster up for grabs.
Okay.
All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.